The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Fridays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hey, it's time to move forward with your News Dissector. I'm Danny Schechter, here every week at this time with the News Dissector Radio Hour on Progressive Radio Network. And every week we try to look at the news, what's in the news, what's behind the news, what's under the news, and what you can learn that you're not learning in the news. So that's part of what we're about. And today we're going to have a fascinating program dealing with one of the great newspapers of record, the New York Times. And with us in the studio is Chris Spanos, who's the editor of NYT Examiner. Chris lives all the way out in the borough of Brooklyn. He found it very difficult to get here on time, but he is on time, and he is going to be joining us. And you just take my coats right off of that, throw them on the floor, and have a seat. So we're here with you for the next hour to talk about newspapers, to talk about news, to talk about Occupy Wall Street. And then in the second half hour, we're going to be going to South Africa, to Durban, South Africa, to meet the organizer of the protests against the climate summit, the big international UN climate summit that starts next week. And the folks there call it the summit of the polluters, not the summit of the anti-polluters. And we'll find out why in a few moments. But today, folks, is Black Friday. I'm sure you've just back from shopping, being in the crowds. If you were at Walmart outside of L.A., there was a good chance he could have been pepper sprayed. 20 shoppers were pepper sprayed by a woman who was feeling that they were being jostled. These people, had to be carried out of the Walmart store. It was like 20 people hurt in this pepper spraying incident. You remember a year or two ago, there was another incident at another Walmart where people rushed into the store. And as a consequence, somebody was hurt. I don't remember if they were killed, but hurt very seriously at a riot inside of Walmart's. This is what the shopaholic craziness does to many Americans who feel like they're going to get a bargain. And yet, today in the New York Times, a very interesting story, which you may or may not have seen. It's tucked away on page one and in the digest of stories. And it's basically about an analyst who has studied Black Fridays over the years, and what he's found, if I can find this, I'll read it to you. Using digital records from retailers, a computer science professor forecasts the best time for bargains, and it's often not, he says, the day after Thanksgiving. So much for all the hype about this is the only time to get bargains. It's not true, but you'll notice in many cases it's a joint marketing exercise between the media and the marketers and the retailers. And why is that? Because this is when all the advertising is being spent in the Christmas season, and all of the news organizations, particularly local TV news, wants to please those retailers, wants to please those advertisers. And so they do what they call SLRs, silly live remotes, from the parking lot of the mall. The place is packed. The truck, you can't even get in. It's so amazing. It's just basically to get you in there and get you shopping, and basically get the advertisers to give them more advertising on radio, TV, and in the press. And so that's a phenomenon that you don't get to see. I have an article up this morning on my blog, newsdissector.com, which is called Will Shopping Save Us? And this is really a kind of a look at consumption. You'll remember when George Bush told us right after 9/11 that the one thing most Americans could do to help their country in this time of great need was to go shopping, okay? And what he understood, what many don't, is that consumption is what's driving, the economy in many ways. And this consumption is artificially created, promoted by media, but also funded with credit cards so that people start shopping and then they accumulate tremendous amounts of debt as the credit card prices go up. And in fact, one of the things I report in my column on NewsDissector.com this morning is that the retail industry, the marketers, the big stores, they have a trade association, and they are suing the Federal Reserve Bank, saying that the Federal Reserve Bank did not significantly enough cut the cost of debit cards. And as a consequence, people are paying more money from their purchases to the banks than to the retailers. And so you have a kind of a little war erupting, an intra-capitalist war between the retail sector and the bank sector, with the retailers saying the banks are screwing the consumers. You know, hello, that's not a particular surprise if you've been following the whole Occupy Wall Street movement. Obviously, you have a situation where many people believe the banks are screwing the consumers and the American people. In fact, today in the New York Times, which we're going to discuss in a second, Paul Krugman, who writes twice a week, the Princeton-based economist, Nobel Prize winner, seems to be kind of a left Democrat, says today basically he loves the slogan 99%, but he thinks it's not factually accurate. Actually, it's only 0.01% of the public that is the super rich in America, not 1%, 0.01%. And he's basically saying that, maybe it should be 99.5% or whatever as the slogan. Isn't there a song, 99.5% just won't do? Maybe Matt can find that for us and we can play it on YouTube. 99.5%, I think it's appropriate somehow. At any rate, here we are on News Dissector Radio. We're getting ready for you to meet our guests. You can call in at 888-874-4888. Kat Waters is with us, and she was very active in various Occupy events and will bring us up to date on some of them. She went to a big protest at the Federal Reserve Bank, which was not a big protest because it was pouring, but she'll tell us about that and some other stuff about the Occupy movement. Chris Spanos in a minute, but first, an appropriate song for this season of consumption.
Got free money, but you have to pay. Got free money, but you have to pay.
Shop till you drop,
the American way. Got free money, but you have to pay.
From the sea to the shining sea.
Got free money, but you have to pay.
Signing up for bankruptcy.
Got free money, but you have to pay.
The credit was easy, the small print sleazy. The devil in the detail, a Molotov cocktail. We all got punked by the subprime chunk. The sign on the lawn says the house is gone.
Hey, that's Polarity One, one of the musicians that's worked with me on my various films, In Debt We Trust and Plunder. He's got a whole album of fantastic music about the economy, which you can download for free from PolarityOne.com, his website. And this song and many of the others that we've been playing over the many months here on News Dissector Radio are available, and you can download them and hopefully pass them on to others. They're really clever songs about the economic pain that most Americans are in. So, Kat, just before we get into the New York Times, let's get into your Times. What's your week been like? I mean, I understand you were down at Occupy yesterday. You've been involved with what's happening. You should know that the Washington Post has an article today that says OWS is over. They've decided to write the obituary.
Well, I went down there yesterday. There wasn't a lot of people. I think people took off because of, they'd just given it a break for Thanksgiving week. But I took a picture. This guy who was handing out the Occupy Wall Street Journal had the schedule of protests for today. And so I just took a picture of it. And at 1 o'clock, they're having a woman's march. At 2 o'clock, there's a march for reparations. And the one that I plan on going to at 3 o'clock, at 56th and 6th Avenue, is a march against the war, starting at 56th Street and 6th Avenue at 3 o'clock today. And then from 4 to 6, I believe, down at Zuccotti, they're going to march for Egypt. And then there's another one at 6:30 for someone who cops slain this guy, Sean Bell, a few months back. And there's going to be a march for him at 6:30.
Memo to the Washington Post. Please withdraw that article saying OWS is over. Apparently it's not over. And in fact, there's going to be an even bigger demonstration next Tuesday, 58th Street, 2nd Avenue, in front of the Egyptian consulate. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be a protest against the Egyptian military junta. And in fact, in that protest, the Islamic Council of New York is endorsing it. They're going to be there as well. So this is something you might want to be part of, and it's being organized by OWS. So it's a sign of international solidarity. If you want to show some solidarity, you can call us at 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888 here on News Dissector Radio. Chris Spanos is here, and I just wanted to welcome you with an important story from the New York Times, your favorite newspaper, at least the newspaper you're trying to provide an antidote for, with your new website, nytexaminer.com. It's a must-read, and you can sign up to be part of it as well. But here's the story, Chris, and let's start off, if you have a comment for this, because it's getting a lot of attention here in the New York Times. Ladybug, ladybug, welcome back home. Good news for the official state insect. The bug is back. It's not just any bug, but the native nine-spotted ladybug, and its reappearance is something of a relief because it is the official New York state insect, even though the last recorded sighting of it in New York was 29 years ago. So for 29 years, we have not heard about the disappearance of the insect, but one of the bugs are back, and now there's a whole big story with a photo in the New York Times, page A30. It's a must-read this morning. Chris, you read the New York Times thoroughly every day, and I think that's part of what prompted you to create this new website. Tell us about it.
Well, thank you, Danny, and thank you very much for having me down today. You know, that story about the ladybug appearing is interesting because I think it's emblematic very much of lots of New York Times reportage, where there's lots of stories that don't appear for 30 years or whatever, and they don't get the kind of attention that this ladybug is getting. And so the New York Times Examiner is set up with the mission of advocating for new editorial values that does give space to those important issues of the day and to advocate for new editorial policies, but with a different twist to other alternative media outlets and advocacy groups.
Well, you know, you're very uncool, Chris. You know that you know, most of the people, I think, down at Occupy Wall Street, you know, would see the New York Times as some sort of a relic of an earlier age, and they're totally into Twitter and Facebook and social media and all the rest of it. And, you know, you are still kind of focused on or thinking about mainstream media. Why is it important to do that along with social media?
Well, it's interesting because the New York Times has this reputation as the agenda-setting press, and yet the agenda of what's on, you know, the 99.5% of people in the U.S. and even outside the U.S. is very much different than the agenda of the New York Times, and so I think the way that social media is people are using social media to organize, and also how the New York Times uses social media is very different, and it does show a divide at the New York Times. So I interviewed an Occupy Wall Street a protester who was camped down there from the very early days and who was interviewed by the New York Times in an article maybe 6 weeks ago.
Was his name Germ, by any chance?
No.
I remember the story. It was like, you know, they had the feature writers writing about it before the news writers. You know, they would come up with catchy lead paragraphs like, his name is Germ. He's standing in front of a sign that says, you know, whatever, something ridiculous. And that's how the whole movement was being introduced to the readers of the New York Times originally. I think that news approach changed, but still.
Well, the headline of this particular article was two opposite sides of the protest meet, comma, briefly. And they had a protester and a Wall Street executive, Wall Street banker. And they obviously picked out this protester according, you know, to their editorial values and how they want to frame things. And what you're saying with this person named Germ, they picked out somebody with a very bright pants and a flary hat, and this was their representation of the Occupy Wall Street stuff. And
nothing like a little stereotyping, Catherine, huh? Have you noticed this in the press also, on TV, that they look for the people who maybe are the least articulate and are, you know, basically, you know, people that you wouldn't want to have home for dinner?
Well, I mean, I definitely think they don't want to, you know, show it in a good light, you know, that they have an agenda to show it in a negative light, and so they make these choices, you know, consciously to do that.
And, you know, when they did this for this article, they framed it in a very offensive way to this guy from Occupy Wall Street. They referred to him as a privileged kid, you know, based on the school that he had gone to. Because he was able to, he was in debt, first of all, and his parents were in debt for sending him off to this education. But he got a lot of money to go to school from, you know, a relative who died and left him some money. So he was very upset by this portrayal. And I had a chance to speak with him on a NYT Examiner about this framing.
You know, so it's sort of the texture of these articles that many of us may not be sensitive to. You know, a lot of us are, you know, into like reading, even though we deny it, reading the headlines, you know, catching the first few sentences. We don't even read the full article or get the whole sense of it. And a lot of times, you know, buried, first of all, a lot of times the real truth is buried at the bottom of the article. I'll tell you about a little story about that. But, you know, also, it seems as if the way portraits and profiles are kind of fleshed out, they tend to make you not want to take seriously the people that they don't particularly like or trust.
Yeah. For example, there's a headline today on Egypt by David D. Kirkpatrick, and the main protagonist in these stories and lots of New York Times coverage is the Egyptian military, and the Muslim Brotherhood. But it's not until you get to page A16 that you hear more about the protesters and their call for social justice and the end to the Mubarak regime and the institutions that have contained the residue of Mubarak.
I was speaking to a Arab you know, American who's lived here for many years from Lebanon, who follows events in the Middle East very closely, and he really objects to this framing of the Egypt crisis as, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood versus the military. He says, you know, there's this tremendous labor movement in Egypt that doesn't get covered at all, that there have been all these strikes, that, you know, all these activists are not necessarily in the Muslim Brotherhood. And also the Muslim Brotherhood is not necessarily one thing. There are factions within it. There are, you know, left and right. There are different sides to it. And, you know, by labeling it in one way, people get an image of something which they may not even realize, that the United States was quite happy with the Muslim Brotherhood for a long time because they were a very conservative force in Egypt when the activists and, you know, the Facebook, you know, generation took over Tahrir Square. They were longing for, you know, for the Muslim Brotherhood to step in and, you know, stabilize the situation. So tell us a little bit more about the website itself and how it functions and how people can access it. And I should make as a point of disclosure that, you know, Chris called me early on when he was doing this website, invited me to contribute some sort of commentaries or quick reads of the headlines of the New York Times. And I've done a few via Skype, which are on, you know, the website. So it's really kind of cool that the day the paper comes out, not a month later, not 2 years later when an academic study comes out, but that actual day, you can have somebody commenting on the spin in the story and offering another perspective. And that's what, you know, I'm sort of doing. Hopefully I'll do more of them with him. You know, if I don't, I had one person call and said, "You're bobbing your head too much. You look ridiculous, you know." And you know, forgive me, I worked in rock and roll radio for all these years. My brains are a little addled. So, Chris, tell us more about the website itself and how you built it and what kind of response you're getting.
Well, people can access the website at nytexaminer.com, like New York Times, nytexaminer.com. And the website looks like the New York Times. It kind of feels like the New York Times, but hopefully with a more spread out front page, and it's easier on the eye, easier to digest. There's still lots of information there, so you'll be able to find lots of critique of daily columns, like Danny said. You'll find analysis of New York Times content within the framework of international law or scientific consensus on important issues, which is the kind of advocacy that we do at NYT Examiner that we think are important editorial decision-making. So we have lots of columns. We have Danny's column. We have a column called Fire Tom Friedman. It's a column that's just going after Tom Friedman in a very humorous and clever way. We have a column called Reality Checks, which is by a very prolific commenter on New York Times op-ed pieces. She's been commenting there for years. Her name is Marie Burns, and she recently left the she recently embarked on a boycott of New York Times comments, their comments section, because she didn't receive one of their invitations to be a trusted commenter after years of commenting and being voted popular commenter. So she's writing a column.
I mean, I've had maybe two letters published over a 20-year period, so I wouldn't consider myself a frequent flyer in the New York Times world. I've, you know, obviously tried. The last story about me appeared in the New York Times by a former New York Times reporter, Chris Hedges, who we all know. And, you know, Chris wrote about me, and I think that was his last story in the New York Times. So it was sort of a feature story. You know, he was mostly right, factually. And, you know, it does get read widely, and you do want to be taken seriously. And so as critical as you may be about the New York Times, you're also kind of, you know, enthusiastic if the New York Times actually writes about you in a non-disparaging way, you know, which is very unlikely, but nevertheless does happen from time to time, because then you're, quote, taken seriously by others when, you know, it's sort of a validating mechanism that the elite, you know, of New York considers you, you know, worthy of some ink. And, you know, so there's a dynamic there. We hate the New York Times, on the other hand. We're in the New York Times. I mean, and there are people who are just not in the New York Times almost ever, like Noam Chomsky, for example. You can't go to a college campus at which he's speaking where the auditorium isn't totally packed to the gills, okay, of people. You know, he's written like 85 books. I mean, the man is a superstar. I once saw him on the book TV, and they did a kind of a roll, a scroll of all of his books, and which went on forever, you know, of all the books. I've never seen it in one place, you know. But Noam has had a situation where he's frequently criticized the Times and rarely is in it.
It's not exactly as if they don't even have access to Noam's writings, because something that's occurring that not a lot of people know about is that Noam actually has a syndicated column for the New York Times. He actually has a syndicated column that appears, I don't know, maybe it's once a month or twice a month. It goes out internationally. The New York Times doesn't publish it, so nobody sees it. They own the copyright to it. And it's predominantly either international media that pick it up outside of the U.S., so people inside the U.S. don't see it, or alternative media who have to fork out the money to pay for this. And this is one way of controlling who sees and who doesn't see.
And that's fascinating. Like New York, we hate you, but you can write for us because we can make some money off of you, kind of.
And keep
idea.
You out of the public sight.
So now, what kind of feedback are you getting? I know you've just been online for a few weeks now. Or, you know, what's been the reaction?
Great reaction. People are writing about it in various blogs. People are writing into me. People are commenting on articles who were formerly commenting on New York Times articles. New York Times readers are reading it. Journalism professors and students are reading it. Hopefully other editors are reading it. I'm getting reporters in Thailand writing to me saying that they're interested in critiquing New York Times reporting on Thailand. And, you know, so the kind of response has been very, very hopeful.
In the internet age, things go global very quickly and people pick up on stuff. And I think the New York Times is a global brand. I mean, what's interesting about it is when, you know, I write for Al Jazeera website. And the people at the Al Jazeera website tell us that they actually have a bigger audience than the New York Times website, which is surprising because the New York Times is such a major brand and such a big website. But apparently, because Al Jazeera has such a global reach and is in so many countries and is read by people probably that don't live off of reading the New York Times, they have a big reach with their website as well. They're one of the big ones in the world now, maybe even bigger than BBC, although I'm not sure about that. But, you know, what's interesting is having a website that doesn't just report news, but reports analysis of news, context of news, examines the news. That's what we've missed for a long time. And you know, the Occupy movement, Catherine has brought in a copy of the new Occupied Wall Street Journal, which is this issue is terrific, okay, with, you know, Cornel West is in there, Barbara Consalver's in here, Tavis Smiley is in here, and there's a lot of featured people, but this is also, they also have a website, Occupied Wall Street Journal, and I would really call your attention to it. Their point is not to critique the, not to critique the Wall Street Journal, but to create an alternative to the Wall Street Journal. Do you think, you know, that is a good idea? I mean, isn't Huffington Post supposedly an alternative to the New York Times in some way?
You know, the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times are two of the largest papers in the U.S., and so I think it's crucial that these projects exist, especially right now where people are stirring, their ideas are stirring about how they want to change society and make things better. And, of course, there are other outlets like the Huffington Post and others. I think what's great about Occupy Wall Street Journal and what we're aspiring to do at NYT Examiner is to provide something that's very critical, based in values of social justice and other standards, the ones that I mentioned earlier, international law and issues of progressive war and other things. These things push the envelope for this other media that just exists out there, and they have their own spectrum of reporting and critique of the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or other media, that they can have a profile of a Hollywood star right next to something maybe critical of Obama, and then, you know, sandwiched in there is something critical of the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, and I think providing much more concentrated focus of these critiques of these two powerful institutions is extremely important.
Of course, the most popular newspaper in America, I believe, at first was National Enquirer. I think that was the overall circulation leader, but, you know, the USA Today, a Mick paper, as it was called when it started, after McDonald's, you know, kind of a quick fast food version of the news, became very popular because they gave it away at hotels and all over the United States. So they built a big audience for that in the mainstream, you know, flyover areas of the United States. But it's true that the Wall Street Journal and the Times have big circulations and, to some degree, different analysis. But how would you describe New York Times' editorial stance?
The editorial stance is one that projects a false objectivity. For example, you have the editorial pages, and they may come out one time critical of war, occupation, or extrajudicial assassinations by drones in Pakistan, or whether it's Obama or something. And then another time they may come out in favor of aggressive war making without any reference to international law. The reader's left absent of any sense of a reference point.
There's no consistency.
There's no consistency. And you mentioned the Paul Krugman. This is on the op-ed side of the editorial pages, but you have Paul Krugman's column today, and on the opposite side you have David Brooks. David Brooks often comments on economic issues, but he's not an economist, whereas Paul Krugman is a Nobel-winning economist. And yet these two are given spaces. If they're equal, they have equal, you know, status to comment on these issues, and they clearly don't.
The Arab scholar I referenced earlier told me an interesting story. He's a mathematician. And I said, you know, have you ever been considered for the Nobel Prize in mathematics? And he said, there is no Nobel Prize in mathematics. And I said, how come? He said, because Alfred Nobel's wife was having an affair with a mathematician. And as a result, he banned all mathematicians from winning the Nobel Prize. That's a little, little factoid for you as we move forward. So, Chris, in doing this, do you find yourself appreciating the paper more or becoming more critical of it?
The New York Times is very overwhelming. I appreciate the breadth and scope and the amount of resources they put into it, and there are definitely some good reporters, and it takes a lot of work to coordinate some of the articles. Some of these articles have seven authors on them. They have two lead articles and then maybe two lead authors and then five contributing authors at the end that they list. That said, it makes you wonder to what extent is information being reorganized for the reader to leave out important standards and issues and voices if they put that much resources towards it.
And if you were to edit the New York Times, I think you'd find it extremely overwhelming to deal with it because you're not just dealing with information, you're dealing with a whole culture of objectivity, neutrality, you know, a whole history, a whole legacy, the Times, board, it's a corporation. It's not just you and the news. It's you and the news and the whole accoutrement of the New York Times behind you. One sec.
Yeah, and that gives it a stature, like august legitimacy that people don't question just because of the power that it contains and that it presents itself with or projects. And you know, there's something I do want to mention that's they have some good reporters. Natasha Leonard was a reporter reporting on Occupy Wall Street, and she was a journalist doing freelance reporting for the New York Times, and she was arrested on Brooklyn Bridge when those 700 to 800 people were arrested in the very early on, about a month and a half ago. And after that, she then participated in some Occupy Wall Street strategy sessions. The New York Times distanced themselves from her because of this. The right attacked her, brought it out publicly. The Times distanced themselves. Natasha has since distanced herself from mainstream media, which you can read about in Salon.com. We also republished that on NYT Examiner. But this is interesting. You know, the whole critique of Natasha Leonard was that there was a conflict of interest. She was reporting and also participating on and in this movement, whereas yet you can have somebody like Ethan Bronner, the Israeli desk manager, who's based in Tel Aviv, and have his son in the IDF, and that this is not
in the Israeli army.
Yes, and yet this is not seen as a conflict of interest by the New York Times, and they somehow put their whole weight behind this, and whatever they say seems to have some legitimacy by critiquing Natasha, but critiques of Bronner aren't ever heard.
Or, for that matter, pointing out the conflicts of others, like our mayor, Mayor Bloomberg, whose live-in girlfriend is on the board of Brookfield Properties, okay, and whose, economic interests are so aligned with Wall Street, so that his comments are, come from a very self-interested place, and it's not somebody who you can just write about without pointing out repeatedly these contradictions or conflicts and whatnot. Kat, comment?
Oh, I just wanted to say it sounded like what you described before was like a sort of editorial cocktail, designed to kind of make the reader like a little bit loopy so they can't really get, it straight.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when I'm finished reading these sections, I often feel like fuzzy in my thinking.
All right. Well, listen, I'm really happy to be presenting this information to our audience, to tell you about NYT Examiner, to urge you to sign up for its newsletter, to read it alongside the New York Times every day and see what you're missing, because a lot of the problem with media is not just commission, bias, but omission, leaving out lots of information and facts. And Chris Spanos and his team over there at NYT Examiner deserve a lot of credit for their gutsy, initiative that they've taken, and I really think this is something that we will come back to in the future and probably have you on to do some commentaries about your experience of covering the New York Times, covering others. So stay with us now. We're going to be going to South Africa in a few minutes to hear about this coalition of polluters that is meeting in Durban, South Africa, the big UN International Climate Summit. You may remember the one in Copenhagen that was completely derailed by the United States. Now it's round two, and we'll hear more about it. Actually, it's the I think the 17th meeting of the COP, they call it, the coalition of whatevers, and we'll hear from them in a minute. So stay with us here on News Dissector Radio on PRN.
Fantastic.
That's the Talking Heads, Nothing But Flowers. We wanted some environmental song to introduce this particular segment. Joining us now from Durban, South Africa, Patrick Bond, professor at the University of KwaZulu-Natal, a very prolific author and writer. Most recently, he's written a piece calling on the movement in South Africa to occupy this new conference, this UN conference that's taking place. I posted his article in my blog at newsdissector.com this morning. Good morning, Patrick. I know you rushed. Tell our listeners a little bit about what's happening there and how it's emerging.
Well, you know, Danny, it's so good to be with you. We had you here in Durban just weeks ago, and I made such a big impact. And I'm actually just stepping away from a dinner with Paulo Salon, the ex-Bolivian ambassador to the UN, and he was, of course, the Cancun conference of the Party 16 dissident. He stood up as a Bolivian and said this deal that's going down in the major UN climate negotiations last year will cook the planet. And he's just been telling us right now, in a little dinner that, okay, well, we've got to learn from the occupiers of New York how to make this discourse about the 1% inside the UN meeting here in Durban against the 99%, all of us on the planet who are going to be, especially from Africa, cooked because of the huge increases in temperature and the extreme violent weather events, you know that well. And of course, the terrible impact on energy and sovereignty and water access diseases. So this is what it's all about. It's the planet. And for the next 2 weeks, I hope all eyes are on Durban and solidarity with the refreshing.
Yes, this hasn't gotten a lot of attention yet, Patrick, in the United States, and it should. It's going to be a really big undertaking there. There's going to be major protests, but there's also, you know, an effort there to talk about the future. The Financial Times this morning reports that the United States has dropped out of funding the Climate Justice Fund that the UN has been trying to put together to deal with this problem. The Mail and Guardian in South Africa is reporting that it's unlikely that anything substantive on the climate front will happen before 2020. And here we are in 2011. People have been talking about this. We've seen the handwriting on the clock is ticking on climate. Countries like cities like Durban are threatened. It's a beach area which could be overwhelmed by, you know, a big shift in the weather and a big shift in the climate. So this is a life and death issue for many countries in the world. It's not some abstraction. It's not something that you can debate. It's actually happening. So what is the UN planning to do, and what are you planning to do?
So the UN, in fact, met today as an executive board for their little technique of carbon trading called the Clean Development Mechanism, and we showed up at the meeting, about 50 of us, including Pablo Salon and Nima Bassi, the great Nigerian, Bobby Peake, the Goldman Award winner here in Durban, and protested, and there were a few of the executive board members, so our first kind of blood, if you like, opening up the protests for the next couple of weeks was at the Moses Mabhida Stadium and basically drove the carbon traders away from their delicious. And so that's the sort of spirit. The UN is basically turning to the market. The markets don't work. We've seen the price of carbon, in which you're supposed to sort of allow the traders to find the optimal level by which you can adjust bit by bit, marginally, changing things just small bit, and you do that using market mechanism. The problem, of course, Danny, like you show so well on financial markets, don't give them the planet, they're messing up their own sector. And that means that for carbon trading, about 35 euros a ton is what it would take to buy a ton of carbon 3-4 years ago. It went down to about 7 or 8 euros a ton, and the Union Bank of Switzerland last Friday said they expected to go down to 3. Now, this is supposed to be a market moving from $140 billion a year 3 years ago up to $3 trillion, the most valuable commodity to trade in the right to pollute, really. It's privatization of the air. And the fact that it's just failing, it's moving in a very volatile way, it's fraught with fraud and corruption, means that the main vehicle in the Kyoto Protocol chosen to solve the problem, the UN still believes in it, World Bank is pushing it hard, it's not working. And so
let's just explain this. Let's explain this.
Climate fund.
Patrick, one sec. Let's just explain this to our listeners who may not be following all of this. A company can buy what they call carbon credits, which is the right to pollute and lower the standards in a given area. And by putting this money up, they're putting it supposedly into a fund to help other countries. But in fact, it's a process that's deeply compromised by various mechanisms of corruption. And it seems as if we're going around and around and going nowhere. Am I right?
That's quite right. And, you know, if the listeners would like a quick and easy 8-minute version, I can't give you a better suggestion than storyofcapandtrade.org. If you just go to the storyofstuff.org website, where they just put up Story of Broke, but you can find the little film I helped Andy Ledden work on called The Story of Cap and Trade at thestoryofstuff.org. And that'll give you 8 minutes of why that whole idea that you can take a market problem, pollution is caused by the failure of markets to correct for externalities, to price in pollution. And then you say, well, let's let the bankers, let's let Goldman Sachs solve that problem. Hey, it's absolutely crazy. But it was what Al Gore, you know, like Hillary Clinton in Copenhagen, promising a big green climate fund, which, as you say, is not materializing. In 1997, Al Gore said, if you go along with us and let corporations buy the right to pollute and trade in the carbon market, then the U.S. will sign the Kyoto Protocol. But it was a lie, and Gore really was a huckster. He gave us a 95-0 Senate vote against the Kyoto Protocol in 1998. So, I mean, this is the sort of gaming that we've come to expect from Washington, true sabotage. And that's why the UN conference underway here in Durban actually will be known as the COP17, the Conference of Polluters. And that's why outside we're trying to say, let's have protests against the UN, but also let's say, what do we want to do? What's climate justice as an alternative? So there we've got protests against oil and coal extraction, against fracking, which in New York you're leading us on. And there's also visions of a new society without privatized transport, coal and fossil fuel-based energy, without the kind of materialistic consumption systems that the U.S. pioneered to sell more goodies. And these are the sorts of things that we really need brilliant and visionary and militant protests, as we have got to do in New York in the Occupy. I was actually there just before Zuccotti Park was cleared. I'm so anxious to hear where the next part, because in Durban we'll be doing an Occupy across the street from the ICC, a park called the Speaker's Corner. And inside, even some of the third world elites are saying, yeah, we should occupy. We should do a sit-in as well.
Well, South Africa is a protest, rich country. In fact, I'm told that among the countries in the world, there's a race between South Africa and China for which country has the most protests. And now Occupy Wall Street is challenging, this club. But, folks in South Africa know how to march. They know how to protest. These are not people who are new to this. They've been fighting apartheid. They've been fighting the post-apartheid apartheid. And I think they'll be fighting against this UN summit to get the voices of the people heard. Do you think you'll get a good turnout in Durban for this protest against the Conference of Polluters, as you call it?
Yes, what we've got, Danny, is the standard alternative summit. It's actually at the university I teach at, the University of KwaZulu-Natal, and at www.c17. That's listeners can follow or watch our website, ccs.ukzn.ac. .va, and you can put those up on your web.
I don't know if we can follow all that, but okay. You can look it up in Google.
We'll do a people space at University of KwaZulu-Natal, and on December 3rd, we're calling a global day of action. The social movements and community groups, labor and environmentalists, all united. And as you know, Danny, that's not very easy in South Africa. We have a typical split between labor and community, because labor has traditionally allied with the government, and communities and environmentalists have been critical of government. So this is a great day on December 3rd, Saturday, and we're hoping that if you care about your Coney Islands and your other beaches that your listeners are very fond of, for us in Durban, our beach is our most democratic public space, probably in the whole country, and we want to defend it from the rising waters, and that means we're and a march all the way to the beach in one of the major hotspots of apartheid protests, going right by the U.S. consulate and City Hall and the International Convention Center. We're hoping for 34,000. We're not sure. But that would be the signal to say, we don't think the Conference of Polluters is the way forward. We're going to go to the beach and defend it. We're going to go out to protest at some of the sites like the big petrol refineries here in South Durban from where I'm speaking. We had an explosion, for example, Danny, on October 10. 100 kids were put into the hospital because of a major refinery having a fire and shooting off hot globules of oil into the air that landed on school kids half a kilometer away, putting them in the hospital. And that's the kind of politics of resistance that people are really getting. They're saying, no, close these things. Stop the oil. The slogan that's been brought to us from the Niger Delta or from Ecuador, leave the oil in the soil and keep the coal in the hole. Leave the tar sand in the land. Of course, the Canadians fighting against the tar sands and a great many people, 1,250 arrested at the White House a few weeks ago, fighting to stop Barack Obama from importing the tar sands, and seems like maybe successful on that front. So we're getting a lot of good internationalism, people who have led this climate justice movement for years and now saying, well, we thought Durban might just be a dud, but in fact it's a very exciting place to be.
So, once again, the place to turn for the history of cap and trade is Annie Leonard, who's brilliant. Her storyofstuff.org website, you should go there. It's quite dramatic. And, in fact, I have with me one of the editors of the new website that monitors the New York Times. Maybe we can get him to put it up on the New York Times as his site on his anecdote to the New York Times website to show how issues can be explained and should be explained. Annie Leonard is brilliant, and Patrick, you've been a dynamo on this issue, educating so many people, motivating so many, inspiring so many. I'm so happy that you could find some time in the middle of all of this to join us here. It's really important that listeners in this country get in touch with what's happening in the world, you know, get what's happening in Egypt, what's happening in other countries and in South Africa in the next few weeks in terms of the climate justice movement, because this is something that affects all of us, too. So thanks again, Patrick Bond, for joining me from Durban, South Africa. Much obliged.
We'll talk again, Danny. You keep up the great work there, and keep inspiring us, the occupiers listening, because we really are getting something we never thought we'd get from the U.S. That is a sense of militancy, purpose, and strategy, and a really good rhetoric about the 1%. Needing to be overthrown by the rest of us 99.
Thank you. I mean, what you're saying really echoes the views of many people in other countries who are amazed, delighted, and supportive of what's happening in this country, the movements, the Occupy movements. Let's cut off his phone so we can move on here. Patrick Bond joining us from the University of KwaZulu-Natal in Durban, South Africa, where the UN Climate Summit is about to happen. They're already meeting there, and protesters are already staking out plans to occupy part of Durban to call attention to this, and they're going to be marching to the beaches and everything else. Now, here's a story that's quite impressive, quite big in momentum, and I haven't seen it really all over the front page of the New York Times, Chris.
No, I haven't seen it either, and, you know, environmental coverage in the New York Times is often lacking. So if you look at, say, The Guardian in the UK or The Independent, you'll notice they have an environmental link in their top tab menu area. The New York Times doesn't have this, and so we've placed this on our site, an environmental section in which users can access ecological issues, and we would expect that when the New York Times reports this, that they do so through the lens of scientific consensus on climate change and global warming, not void of those standards. And so we'll look for Times reporting on this issue, and we'll cover that as well.
Catherine, did you find it interesting that here was somebody from South Africa who had been to Zuccotti Park, who's taking the ideas from Zuccotti Park back to South Africa to help create an Occupy movement there?
Well, I mean, it looks like every place, everywhere in the world needs to occupy, you know, something. I mean, it sounds, you know, what you know, he described about, like, you know, purchasing, you know, the ability to pollute. I mean, it sounds like the financial derivatives that, you know, Wall Street makes up. You know, like, I mean, it's crazy. It's just...
crazy it is, but it's happening, and the fact that there are people protesting it and that there is this global movement for climate justice happening is very important, because many countries are being really hit hard by this extreme weather and are in danger of surviving. Some island states could actually sink into the bottom of the sea. I think the Maldives Island had a meeting of their leaders underwater in scuba gear to illustrate this point of what's coming down the pike unless the world does something to deal with this climate justice issue. And so far the world isn't, and that's why, you know, what's happening in South Africa, I think, is very significant. I'm sure we're one of the first programs here in the United States to even talk about this issue, to bring it to public attention. I mean, environmental activism is something I think that a lot of people support. People who may or may not be aware of all the Wall Street issues certainly want a planet, their planet, to survive because of their children, because of the future, because, you know, being able to breathe a decent air and drink decent water. I mean, this is something that cuts across every political point of view. Catherine?
I was just going to say really quickly, I mean, it's hard for a lot of people, especially corporations, who are not accustomed to thinking outside of money. You know, you have to put the profit and the financial, you know, glasses and take them off and just think of something in terms of what it is, the wealth of what it is, you know, the environment. Clean water, clean air is healthy for what it is, you know, not for the profit motive actually is what gives it the debt and the disease.
Well, you know, that's certainly a true insight into all of this, and that's why, you know, I wanted to have Patrick Bond. I was in Durban, South Africa, actually not a few weeks ago, but back in June. And, you know, while they were talking about this whole movement and emerging and planning protests against this UN event, remember Copenhagen, you know, people met for weeks, months, coming up with a statement, you know, that they hoped the conference would adopt, and in flew Barack Obama and some major presidents of various countries. And lo and behold, the resolution went out the window and the conference ended without resolving anything. And this could happen again at this conference in South Africa. And that's why we have to at least know about it and understand ways that we can be supportive, just as they are supportive in many ways of Occupy Wall Street and of the movement in this country, which they see as part of their struggle for change. Because, you know, these countries know about Wall Street, know about the economy. Don't forget, the fight against apartheid in South Africa was one of the first fights which called for sanctions against American companies doing business in South Africa. And it was that pressure, particularly on the Chase Bank, then before it was called J.P. Morgan Chase Manhattan, which was loaning money to the apartheid government in South Africa. And it was a pressure from this country, protests, sit-ins at Chase Banks that helped turn them around. And they agreed not to turn over their loans to South Africa. And that was the turning point for the old apartheid regime, along with, of course, the struggles of the people there, the UN sanctions, the UN resolutions, worldwide condemnations, concerts, music, everything else that was against apartheid. But this economic battle was at the center of it, and it was successful. And that's what, you know, we need to remember a little bit of our history, because that history is very relevant to what's happening today with Occupy Wall Street. Occupy Wall Street did not invent the whole idea of an occupation. There were occupations during the Depression. There was an occupation in Washington that Martin Luther King was planning, Resurrection City on the National Mall as part of the protest of the Poor People's Campaign. He was very keen to have an occupation. I was involved in an occupation of the London School of Economics back in 1967. That's what we called it. And it was an occupation to protest against the expulsion of two democratically elected student leaders at the school, which led to a big student strike in London, that I also documented in my first film called Student Power years ago. So this is a recurring theme. We haven't reinvented all of history, but, you know, this movement is extremely important, extremely worth following. And, you know, I've been writing about it every day in my blog. I've been writing articles for Al Jazeera and for other websites about the Occupy movement. I'm actually collecting those articles into a book, and I'll tell you, hopefully by next week, how you can can get yourself a copy of it called Occupy, about this whole movement, of just the first 2 months of what's been done, what's been accomplished, what's been fought over, and you know, some of the battles won and lost of the Occupy movement. As I mentioned earlier, the Washington Post is now willing to say goodbye to Occupy. It's over, according to them, but as Catherine told us, it's, it ain't over yet, and that people are still active. In fact, you know, a lot of people I've spoken to say, wait till the spring, you know, when the weather gets nicer, when you know, the spring has always been the time of renewal of protest. And, you know, I think that we are going to have a couple of months of planning and organizing, and maybe lower profile activism. But this movement is barely over because the problems that created it are not over. The problems that have led to massive unemployment, student debt of indescribable proportions, of foreclosures of 14 million families in America, none of that is over. Okay, and so this movement can't be over because the movement is trying to do something about issues that our media doesn't really cover in detail, and that many of us don't think we can win on. But in fact, if we organize, if the 99.9% organize against the 0.01%, I think that that could change. You can get a podcast of this radio program at progressiveradionetwork.com. You can also write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org if you'd like to. You can find out more about my film Plunder at plunderthecrimeofourtime.com. I'm doing pretty well remembering all these things. It's pretty good for somebody as ancient, 99.9 years old. You know, I feel sometimes. But I'm hanging in here. I want to thank Chris Spanos again for joining us from the NYT Examiner. I want to thank Catherine Waters for being here every week with her reporting on what's happening at Occupy from the grassroots, of the bottom-up kind of perspective. I can hear my voice going a little bit. I have to record a new promo, so I'm going to try to take a little glass of water. We're going to leave you with the song, the theme song of my film, Plunder, with the voice of Bernie Madoff.
For many years, I operated a Ponzi scheme through the investment advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was wrong, indeed criminal.
The shine on America's shoes got gold. When Wall Street stepped into the fold,
Congress paid off, workers laid off.
Stanford, AIG, and Madoff.
Credit swaps, credit stops, empty wallets.